Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Nancy, I think you do such a lovely job of making this such a comfortable place for us to discuss ideas and information. So I really like that. And the questions that you ask really made me go deep into some of my upbringing, which was actually a lot of fun. And in the process, I learned something new about myself as well.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. Today's mentor guest is Lori Healy, a recovery coach and educator in private practice. We've had some great conversations off air and have some really great connections. And in our last conversation, we talked about some of the details involved in little T's and big T's of trauma. And even though it sounds like a simple term in a, you know, coochie-coochie way in which I'm you know, saying the terms, they're actually really have huge implications in the direction that we go and take our lives. In our last conversation, Lori defined trauma, and we'll kind of revisit that a little bit. And there's different categories, and some little, you know, smaller traumas might be big traumas for somebody else. There's very much difference between the two. And little traumas can be being bullied, high stress, financial loss, change in friendships, not being around people who are empathetic and understand you. You know, there's just a lot of different things that over time can accumulate. And it's important for us, I think, as we're getting all these, you know, thousands and thousands of studies over the last 10 years, especially, have come out in positive psychology and the benefits of mindfulness and meditation and having shame resiliency strategies in place, like really naming the shaming experience that you've had, kind of recognizing it and understanding some of when you're triggered, practicing critical awareness, you know, within yourself and also in the environments that you're in, making sure that you're setting some good boundaries for yourself of what's okay and what's not okay. Sometimes I think that takes me a little bit longer to even figure out, yeah, what is okay for me? Yeah, you know, or how far am I willing to go, you know, if something's not working? And then the third is kind of reaching out to others and sharing yourself and your stories. I think that's really important for validation. And then fourth is speaking about shame to keep it from flying under the radar screen and not noticing when it's affecting you in your life. Like you may be having a lot more conversations, even though we're tired of this pandemic, we're nowhere near its end. And so it's important for us to just not stop talking about it, but actually stop about what our experiences are with it and how we're experiencing a transition in the leadership in our country. And is that feeling safer for us? How are we feeling about all the bigotry and you know, all the just the white supremacist comments and all those things? Those are still, we're still working through those things as a society because a lot of people have bought into a lot of lies and conspiracy theories, and it's really muddled up our thinking. And so one way to back out of that is to, you know, practice those critical awareness and start talking more in-depthly about what you're experiencing. And if you're finding that you're just continually talking and spreading conspiracy things that you've just recently read or whatever, you know, stop doing that and go deeper for yourself. Go deeper into the feelings. How is this piece of information affecting me? Is it exploiting my ability to really stay connected with myself? Because one of the things, and I'm going on a little bit of a tantrum, Lori, just before we talk about this, because it's such a big topic and there's so much to learn about it, you know, in terms of us having real conversations and how to figure out how to have those conversations. I started with Anila Idnani and Samir in our conversation with them last week about, you know, we talked about asserting self-love in the workplace. And Kristen Neff, she's a PhD and a pioneer in self-compassion research. And she's authored a book called Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. And she says, and I quote, love, connection, and acceptance are your birthright. End quote. And so we need to protect those things and make sure that we're preserving and building our self-love. And if we're losing the connection to ourself, that's an indicator that we need to shift something in our lives and move into more an acceptance of ourselves so that we can stay present and connected with other people in our lives. So Lori and I are going to get into a discussion about, you know, how can we be real, have real conversations in the workplace? And both of us really enjoy keeping it real with people because it brings a lot of meaning to our lives. And it also deepens the connection that we have with people. And who need, you know, we just need to clear out the stuff in our conversations that are not helping us to connect with each other. And that takes a little bit of a practice. I wanted to also just remind you that Lori is a recovery coach and educator that comes alongside anyone supporting a loved one, friend, or colleague struggling with addiction and co-occurring mental health disorders. She really plunged into developing her own private practice after her brother Brian's passing in 2017 through a substance use disorder. Lori helps families, community allies, and workplaces navigate relationships where mental health and substance use disorders exist. Using evidence-based best practices informed by CRAFT. Lori, what is CRAFT?
CRAFT stands for Community Reinforcement and Family Training.
Ah, okay. You've coached hundreds of individuals to facilitate better communications, implement programming, and help those in recovery to move toward the restoration of relationships. Can you tell me how you've worked genograms into your work with people?
Yeah, genograms are so interesting. And this came about when I was doing the training to become an ARISE interventionist. And one of the things that's really important when we're working with families to address substance use and mental health in the family is to help them understand that this likely didn't start with you. A lot of the situations we're dealing with as individuals can largely be attributed to where we came from, both in terms of any type of illness, whether that be physical or mental, but also in terms of resiliency. And so it's really important through this genogram, which is basically a look at what does our family tree look like over four or five generations as it relates to the experiences we've had as a family. And that's where you start to break things down, like were there other individuals in our family that struggled with addiction or mental illness? How were relationships or challenges addressed in our family? When there was a passing of somebody, how did we get together to remember that person or commemorate them? How did we deal with the unexpected death of a family member? And so by looking at these patterns of communication, it's really, really interesting to start to help that family paint a story of, you know, there have been challenges in your family. And also because of the mere fact you're sitting together here today as a family, you're also very resilient. And we need to be able to help people draw upon those bonds of resiliency in order to move forward and break generational patterns that may have been holding us back.
Well, and that's interesting because in our genealogy charts, it just shows, you know, kind of who was married to who or who wasn't or how many kids people have. And you can kind of see your family tree, but very little is written about mental health. So I'm assuming you get these from the stories within the several generations of families if they're still alive.
You do. This is where it can be really important to sit down with, the elders in your family that are still alive and that have those stories. And they likely have those stories, but maybe they've not told them before. And, I was fortunate enough in my own family, I have an aunt who has now passed, but she was really into genealogy. So she was able to categorize some of those stories. But even if you don't have that, there is a lot of information that's still even available in public records that you can go and seek. But finding, maybe one or two people within the family that are willing to sit down and just even start reminiscing, like, tell me about a family celebration that you remember. What was it like? And listen, really listening to that. This is also a really great way to practice your listening skills within your family is just to have somebody tell you those stories and then write them down. And you'll start to see where patterns evolve and you'll start to understand, that's why we communicate the way we communicate. And until you really start taking a deeper look at this, you might not even be aware of it. So we go back to that awareness factor.
Yeah. As you say this, I'm just thinking about, so we have these collective experiences and we also have in trauma, there's underlying traumas that can accumulate over time. Like I noticed like in college, like where my mental health wasn't quite right. And it sent me on a journey my entire life about being curious to find out more and to seek out help when I needed help before my life took on, something that I felt was too far off the mark and feeling out of control. I went through a lot of, sabotaging myself. But the further along you get, the more understanding you have in all the little ins and outs of where you're triggered and stuff. And I was just thinking that, I started relatively early. I'm hoping that my daughter, who's going to be, turn 19 this month, I'm hoping, she has a lot more skills than I do. So breaking kind of the cycle of dysfunction, of no communication, of never talking about the facts of, when a person experiences a little or big trauma, never talked about, never acknowledged, and never really reached any sense of conclusion about that. So if you've so I can see where, if you end up like starting in your 30s or 40s or 50s with this kind of work where it can be very overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. It's also common. One of the key aspects of trauma is that a traumatic event can freeze that moment in time, implanting, powerful thoughts, emotions, different sensations in our bodies and our brain. And what can happen with that is that those feelings and emotions can remain embedded for years or even decades before that trauma is even addressed or healed.
Yeah, I remember having a trauma where I saw my brother's tractor flipped over when I was in eighth grade, and this was like the second summer that we, had moved to the farm. I was just learning about farm life. And it wasn't till like 10 years later when I would go out for a run. And I had a therapist actually on one of the podcasts who said to me, you're, running to get help. Because I said, why is my, when I would go running during like all of a sudden, and this particular route that I took, when I would go, it would trigger the trauma. Like I would feel, like overwhelmed with experiences of revisiting my brother's tractor flipping over and the steering wheel landed on his arm. And so he couldn't move and he was screaming for me to stay and dig him out. And I knew, oh my God, I can't dig him out. I need to get help. So I ran to get help. And so that was kind of the, when I was running at that particular time, it triggered that. And it was also a place in which I was more safe. So I wasn't moving around a lot at that time. And so I felt like I was, like my mind was safe, feeling safe. And so that was why I felt it started probably coming into my awareness at that time. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, just big stuff. But yeah, you're right about, you get frozen in time and you don't know when it's going to kind of unrelease itself. Or the pieces of it.
Exactly.
So what stats are there around mental health in the workplace?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're definitely almost seems like they're changing every day based too on what we've gone through this past year. They're only climbing. So for example, there's some really great research that's been done around this about what it looks like in the workplace. So 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience a mental illness each year. So it's 20% of our population. And it's interesting that the mental illness actually begins quite young. 50% of it, of all lifetime mental illnesses, begins by age 14. And we're up to 75% by age 24. And so that's a fascinating statistic. And if you think about is everything those individuals at those ages between 14 and 24 are going through, the changes in their lives. And then you put on top of that, this new experience that we've had, in the past year, it's no wonder why there's so many articles and workshops and seminars about like, how are we taking care of our kids' mental health right now? It's really, really important because those are the people that we are hoping, and helping them transition into adulthood to, eventually be running our workplaces. So that's really a staggering statistic to me. And then also just across the U.S. economy, depression, which is the leading cause of, mental health, represents over $210 billion in lost earnings. Wow. So, for people that are trying to put a figure to this,
yeah,
that is really staggering.
Yeah, which also means it's all the relationships to me. Like we've got the money, the dollar amount, and then I'm thinking, and look at all the billions of dollars and all the billions of relationships
that have been
affected along with those numbers.
Well, and to your point, so, yes, we have individuals in our workplaces that are dealing with their own mental health illnesses, but then you also have to think about the caregivers of people that, the family members that are helping those people deal with that. And those caregivers spend an average of 32 hours per week providing unpaid care, which is taking somebody to a therapist appointment or, helping them navigate whatever it is they need help navigating. So what we haven't done well in the workplace, I believe, is that we haven't really normalized those conversations in the workplace because that the shame and the stigma prevent people from speaking up. It's normalized to speak up and say, you know what, my mother is going through cancer. I have to take her to a chemo appointment today. But are we having those same conversations that say, you know what, I need to take my spouse to his, to see his therapist today? It doesn't feel like those are on a level playing field yet.
Yeah, and people are still not comfortable talking about their feelings. And talking and like naming your feeling is the access that you really getting real in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Like you have to recognize, that you have these feelings and, naming those feelings and then kind of investigating them a little bit. Why am I feeling this way? Those are some basic skills that we need to be practicing in the workplace through constructive conversations. In our last conversation, we were talking about the safe environment that you had around that basic study that you did with some tech companies and, a couple of questions that were asked and put on a post-it note revealing that there's a lot of self-doubt, there's a lot of anxiety and overwork and feelings of not being worthy and burnout and, the list goes on and on that you were kind of, brought you into a kind of an alarming realization that this really is something that we need to address more directly with people and with entrepreneurs and business owners in normalizing a way that they can make an emotionally healthy workplace.
I think one of the first things that, business owners can do is just ask themselves, starting with your culture, what does the culture of my organization look like? And what does the culture of my organization look like as it relates to supporting mental wellness? just starting there to be aware of what currently exists. And they, you know, there are some companies out there doing great things, which is really encouraging to see. And I think the more that we can elevate those examples, that's going to help other business owners understand how this ultimately is the right thing to do, but also helpful for the bottom line. We have, you know, more engaged people. They feel like their workplaces are safer, which ultimately leads to retention.
Right. And the feeling of being cared about and, you know, the belonging, I belong here. This person is putting, you know, some places in place in the workplace. This work environment is set up. So I feel like I belong here, like I can work effectively here, like I can communicate with people and share my feelings without feeling like I'm going to be fired.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it's a really fine line. And I think that's why people want to have these conversations, but they also want to make sure that this is a safe place so they don't feel like they're risking losing their job if all of a sudden that they disclose that, hey, I need to go to therapy 3 times a week for something that I'm dealing with. And that can be a really scary place to be, especially if you don't feel like you have a safe work culture.
Yeah. And so we had mentioned in our last conversation, and I started out with kind of this shame resiliency. Those are techniques that you can add into the workplace. And you can have, you know, like on a weekly basis, you know, setting up to have, you know, honest conversations with people. And I have been using this self-awareness mentoring journal that I developed many years ago, and I've updated it. But I have found that is the best, the most efficient way that I help business owners to take responsibility for what they're feeling, which means when you're holding yourself accountable, you're more likely to get ideas for how to hold other people accountable, especially in a work environment where mm-hmm. you can kind of work together with people. But I have found that I save a lot of time by, you know, talking about the feelings and having the person kind of acknowledge their own feelings, you know, circle mm-hmm. them, talk about them with me. Sometimes it takes, you know, a while for me, for the business owner to get comfortable. But it's mm-hmm. important to, the more that you do it, the more comfortable that you get. And the more you can, you know, instead of having the emotions run you, you become in charge of your emotions. Mm-hmm. And even though intellectually we can know this, and I know a lot about this, I find myself sometimes, you know, somebody is telling me, whoa, are you, you know, what are you upset about right now? Because my voice took a change. For the, you know, mm-hmm. went south. And I'm like, oh, okay, good feedback, right? So we're talking about being in tune with oneself, and that's yeah. the good place to start. What are ideas?
I just want to continue to go with that, Nancy, because I think that is such a powerful example of that self-awareness journal. And like, this could be such an easy and simple way that doesn't cost any money for a business owner to start incorporating ways to even signal why mental health is important. So for example, you could have let's say you have a one-on-one with one of your direct reports each week. And, you know, you're going through the agenda, you've got to get a project status update and a couple other things. And, oh, you know, you're going to be out for vacation to submit your PTO, whatever. But maybe there's a section on there, even before, just like your journal, before they walk into that meeting, one of the things they do is say, hey, circle 3 words with how you're feeling today. So that you as the leader has an understanding of where that person is coming from, and now that person, it's totally optional. They could choose not to do it, or they could. But that starts to kind of set the foundation for like, hey, I care how you're feeling. And you know, some people may say, well, I'm not going to do that. But it still is signaling to them that like, as your leader, I'm here, I'm setting the culture, and I'm making sure that you know this is a safe place to discuss these things, whether you feel like it or not.
And, you know, it's important that you're emotionally present.
Yes.
You know, like we want you to be in tune with yourself when you're working mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't want to be, it's really important. We care about you. This is part of how we belong with each other and how we stay connected mm-hmm. is exactly. through emotional presence. And there's no issue that's too big. You know, mm-hmm. if it's too big for, you know, me to talk through, or for you feeling like you know, one conversation is going to lead to many, many, many or it's going to get really big and out of control, and I don't know that I want the cat out of the bag. Well, this is the beginning of the conversation. We don't need it to stop. It's a continuous thing, and we're just going to deal with some parts of what we're each experiencing at a time.
Exactly.
And people need to know, too, like I have had lab sessions where people think this is the place to dump stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they'll come in and, you know, I'll just have had a conversation with them ahead of time. And we get to the lab and I'm like, wow, you know, what's with you? You know, I didn't know you were feeling this sad or you know, but it's like, well, I'm just showing you, you know, my worst self.
Yeah, it can go that way too. We get so worried that, you know, people are going to be scared to speak up and they don't want to talk about it. And then we can have the other situation too, where we feel like we're such a safe space that all of a sudden it opens up. And then I think, you know, that leader is thinking, oh my goodness, how do I now even deal with this? But that's where you call in the experts. If you're dealing with
definitely like there's a bigger issue going on there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's exactly what you're saying. The other thing is
I'm referring to. Yeah.
Okay. And so as a business owner or as somebody facilitating a group, you know, I just encourage them to say, this is about self-leadership accountability. We can talk about this. And if you know, want to bring your self-loathing self to every meeting, you know, you can do that. That's okay. Mm-hmm. And if you need to be in that space the entire time that we're in the session, that's fine. But I also want you to experience a range of emotions. So I know you're comfortable with self-loathing. What are some of the other feelings that you can, you know, kind of get into that might be, you know, worth, you know, kind of drawing you out of the self-loathing so that you're curious to experience some other emotions besides self-loathing or anxiety or, you know, anxiety is just so high all the time, it seems. Lately. And so we have a lot of experience with anxiety. We have a lot of experience, I think, with overwhelm. We have a lot of experience with feeling just depressed. But I don't think we've had an opportunity really to expand those other experiences because there's so much foreboding. Like, oh my God, what's the next bad thing that's going to happen? I don't want to feel joy now because I want to reserve that because I know something bad's going to happen next.
Yeah. And that's why I love what you said at the beginning of our conversation around Dr. Kristen Neff's research. I love her body of work. She does such amazing things around this. And so that understanding how we pull in self-compassion, even in the workplace, is really important.
Yeah, I took her workshop with my husband, Matthew, and it was such a great on self-compassion. And it's such a beautiful thing. He and I are totally in different places with applying it with ourselves. And sometimes we can even be better at applying compassion to other people, but we don't offer the same peace to ourselves. Yeah. But I found that experience drew us closer because we started to having conversations that were deeper about how we're taking care of ourselves or where we spend a lot of the time during the day with our thoughts.
Love that.
Yeah. And so, you know, the job of the business owner is to set up the culture and to role model the culture. And there's more and more chances, there's more and more examples that we're going to have of how to do that. I think there's a lot of information about what doesn't work in a work environment and how you distrust but we need more experiences and more conversations. Really, there's a lot of research now, and there'll be more in the future. But we've got an opportunity now to say we've been in these lots of dark emotions and lots of struggle. How can we work that into the work culture to have those discussions where a person ends up at the end of the conversation where they feel lighter, where they feel like a burden has been shared, and not like they're dumping off responsibility of what their emotions are, but they actually feel like, oh, I now know what I'm experiencing. I now know how to investigate some of these feelings that I have because I have a name for them. And I now can notice where they show up in my everyday life. And I now can see in my workplace when I'm doing a project or communicating with someone and there, you know, there's this handoff that happens with a time element of it, a time frame, you know, you can become more cognizant of where you are, you know, with the cog in the wheel.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And where, mm-hmm. if a ball gets dropped, you know, is this about how do we get it back on track or how do we resolve the miscommunication or how do we move into ways in which we can address the conflict? I wanted to just bring up, just for the listeners and also for us to discuss, there's five different ways that people handle conflict, and they're probably more pronounced now because people's behavior has been a little bit more significant. And so one of the ways is competing. So all these feelings are both assertive and on the range or unassertive or cooperative or uncooperative. It depends upon the situation. Like if you're competing in sports, that's totally appropriate. You know, you're forcing your way to kind of, you know, win the game, whatever it is, or in some sort of competition. But if you're competing, if you're setting up the environment for people to compete against each other, that might be helpful in short-term projects, but it's not healthy over the long period of time. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we're finding that even in classrooms, setting up that environment as a way in which your whole education is and how it's how you measure it is not healthy. And it's very destructive. So collaborating takes a little bit more time, but this needs to be more in a work environment. It's both assertive and it's cooperative. It's a problem-solving way to set up the work environment. Compromising is more intermediate, where it's both assertive and is cooperative. It's the sharing, but sometimes a person gets in the mode, if this is the way they handle every conflict, is they compromise, they can be disempowered over a period of time. So it's important to kind of assert yourself there. And then some people just avoid conflict as soon as they see it or hear it. You know, and that's really unassertive and it's uncooperative because the person usually withdraws. Now, some situations, you just, when there's a conflict, you're just choosing not to get yourself centered in it, which makes sense. But as a common way of handling conflict, it's not the best way to do it because we seem to pick two ways of handling it and they show up in our family of origins a lot. And the last one is accommodating, which is unassertive and cooperative. So you're kind of smoothing over things. And that I see a lot in spousal situations or when business owners have partners, that sometimes one business owner will accommodate the other business owner and they don't speak up. And mm-hmm. over time, it's very destructive in the relationship between the two. So I wanted to include that in our conversation. What do you think about them?
Well, I think that's really important to understand how we can handle conflict and what happens, and then how do we each deal with that? When I hear, you know, conflict too, a lot of times we avoid that conflict in whichever way because we're trying to avoid pain.
Yeah.
And when we have that pain, it usually drives us to some sort of coping mechanism. And that coping mechanism for us, it's different for everybody. So the way that you deal with conflict and pain, Nancy, is different than the way that I deal with it. And so I think that that also is an important element to be looked at in terms of how that conflict gets carried forward.
Yeah, because sometimes as business owners, we can, or just any human being too, we think, well, this is how I'm experiencing it. This is probably how everybody is. Mm-hmm. But there's a different dynamic, a power structure that's also there. And people in different roles and responsibilities we're shifting from a cultures of power, having power and domination over people to, which is why also everything is so disruptive, you know, how do you control people? Well, mm-hmm. in a shared power structure, you're empowering people to take on more risks, to utilize their mind in constructive ways. It's getting rid of this demeaning and shaming environment, and that sets up a person to feel like they have all the answers or know it all. And yeah. frankly, you know, that's a superficial type of confidence that doesn't help with building a shared culture where people will really be empowered to speak up.
Exactly. There's no room for vulnerability in that type of style.
Yeah.
In my book. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can help business owners understand like shifting from that place and knowing that that is shifting to one of curiosity and vulnerability, that's the door that opens for us to start building cultures that truly start to help us understand where do we bring in empathy? Where do we bring in compassion? How do we start asking these hard questions in a way that people feel heard?
Yeah. Absolutely. And the strength in vulnerability is the inner strength that it builds by you claiming what your experiences are and the feelings around it. It's not an external thing, which it looks different than how we have defined strength in the past, in our leaders, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any couple of other tips that you would like to share as we close out our conversation for today? This has been so wonderful. I just really appreciate how you add in another dimension of just each element that I'm bringing in.
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's important a lot of times when, I talk with business owners and people in the company that are responsible for this, they often will say, well, what does a mental health disorder even look like in the workplace? What am I looking for?
Right.
And of course, it depends on the disorder. It's many times you won't even see it. And the reason why is because, you know, there's a huge amount of shame and stigma that individuals deal with when they're dealing with their own mental health disorder.
So it's usually around silence or secrecy.
Or masking and medicating. A lot of how people are coping. I'm going to cover up this part of myself. I'm going to make sure that I don't trip up and show it at work because I don't want to lose my job or I don't want to feel vulnerable. Like I don't want to bring this part of me to work because who I am at work, you know, people like who I am at work. I don't want them to know that I'm struggling with this because they're ashamed of it. So that is why sometimes it can be hard to deal with this. So that's where then we have to start thinking, well, what should I be aware of or what are those signs that somebody might be struggling? And it could be things such as, you know, they're more likely to miss work, or maybe there's abrupt departures during the day. Now that's a little bit harder, especially for business owners that have remote teams. You know, when we have people in person all the time, we can see them more and we see that they're at their desk or we see them having lunch with their colleagues. But when we're dealing in this new remote environment, that can be difficult. But even there, you can look for things like, is their camera turned off a lot? Or are they missing calls? Are they showing up late for calls, leaving early? So some of those things may be indications. Other signs might be there's gaps in their productivity. Or perhaps you've started to notice that there's some strained interpersonal relationships with colleagues, people that used to get together or used to work really well together on a team. There's starting to be some friction there. Or you might be hearing from another team member that, hey, I'm not working with this person as well as I used to. It's really hard to get along with them right now. And those can be sometimes some signs that we need to watch out for.
Ooh, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. So there's lots of room for us to be in tune and watch what people are doing. And as a business owner, our hands have been tied in so many ways, like we've been needing to be responsive, that sometimes we can be less attentive to the people that we're working with. But now that we're moving into the understanding of, okay, this is how we're working in a pandemic, and we can do this indefinitely. Some things we can sustain, some things we can't. want. There's new ways in which we're going to keep innovating. But how can we, you know, so if the emotional intensity is not quite as there, people can pop up their heads out of it and look around and say, okay, now how can we work together more and
right.
develop the structures in our work environment where people can continue to have the conversations.
Well, right. And I, you know, even just simple things, like we talked a little bit about signaling earlier. I tell people, you know, start with what you have, just even being aware of what you have, what's in your EAP program, and communicating that to your team members so they know. Or maybe you include a section in the team handbook for how you address mental health in the organization. And that goes back to our conversation. At one-on-ones, we do this type of check-in. Every third Thursday of the month, we do a mental health lunch and learn. You know, there are just certain things like that that you can be including in the materials for your team so that they understand what that looks like. And then I tell business owners too, you know, work with the company that provides your benefits. What we're seeing now is a lot of these companies are really starting to tune more into the mental health. And so they're providing additional resources and information to help business owners deploy that in their teams.
Yeah. Excellent. Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. This has just been tremendous and very helpful and kind of giving people a place to start. And also just people are at the spectrum of where people are at in addressing the mental health in their work environments is they're on the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a journey. I mean, this is a journey.
Yeah.
And I think coming back to this, as a business owner, make sure you give yourself compassion in this area. You don't have to figure it all out right away, but starting somewhere by becoming aware yourself and really understanding, you know, that need to bring vulnerability and empathy to the workplace, leading by example. You know, you set the culture.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Lori.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. And thank you, listener, for tuning in and give me some feedback. I would love to hear what you're doing in your work environments. What's working? What isn't working? What do you need more information on? I can easily ask Lori to come back and we can address these things together. So I'll see you all next week. Do you want to build upon your leadership skills and become more effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? This is a dual innovation process. We've been doing this kind of work since 1992, helping small business owners and emerging entrepreneurial leaders with self-leadership mastery, business ownership success, and that leads to life success. We focus on the dual innovation journey of reinventing yourself as you redesign your business. We do this with one-on-one strategic mentoring sessions. We have several types of labs that you can participate in with your other peers. Both our entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab, which you can really get into the crux of how to run your business more effectively and become more competent. We have meaningful conversations that help with developing a culture that will work for you. I do weekly meditation and yoga that you can participate in to evolve yourself as you redesign your business. You can also sponsor this podcast. We're always looking for people to support our programming, build out our programming with us, and I especially love promoting you. You can get involved in all those different areas because when we mentor, you design a better life, a more fulfilling future as an entrepreneurial leader / innovator, as a competent business owner / practitioner, as a mentor / role model, and as a human being and master of self. Every client starts with a desire to shift something, clarify something, overcome challenges, grow profitability. We started with one entrepreneur. We've mentored thousands. We're ready to work with you. When you show up, we're here. So to get started, go to wementor.com. You can also call me at 612-804-8920, or you can reach me through email, nancy@wementor.com. Get ready and take the next step today.